Welcome to episode 125 of the Geocaching Podcast, recorded live on October 13th, 2009. Garmin support for custom raster maps. I'm your host, XPunkX, with
Daryl W4 and
Montu Ryder.
If you want to participate on our show today, please call 724-444-7444, and our TalkCast ID is 7525. You can also join our live chat room to participate with our other listeners, and that can be found at www.geocachingpodcast.info. Click the Join Now to Participate button on the right. We have a voicemail line, which can be found at 206-3503-GPS, and we're on Twitter at twitter.com/GCPodcast. Well, Montu, Daryl, welcome back. It's been another week. It's been an interesting week for us, but Montu, what about yourself?
Not much here. Weather's warmed back up again, so the air conditioning's back on, and I'm back staying pretty much in the house. Saturday did the public ride with the trains, and then Sunday had to go back up to the trains. We had had somebody that had specifically asked for a Sunday run for a birthday party, and it turned out that the young gentleman whose birthday we were celebrating, his birthday is the same day as mine, which was yesterday. So we both got a kick out of that and had a grand old time. Other than that, I've been staying inside where it's cool.
Yeah. Well, I was noticing you guys had like 91 or something today. And meanwhile, up here, they're talking about the possibility that we might actually break 50 degrees this week. Yeah, well, it seems like it kind of happened all of a sudden, though. But Saturday, we went caching and shooting, and then shooting and caching on Sunday. We had an event over in the Jackson, Michigan area on Saturday. And if you remember, I was talking last show about that McCurdy Park down in Somerset, Michigan. So Dree and I took off a little early to try to make it out there and get some shots. So we managed to capture all 17 of the bridges on Saturday. Skies weren't as clear and nice as we probably would have liked, but at least we've got it on, you know, disc now. And we actually noticed that some of those bridges were deteriorating a little bit more than we had expected from the last time we were there. So we're glad we got those captured. You know, we've got something to show what they were like when we saw them this year, and hopefully they won't continue to get too much worse. But then Sunday we went out shooting with, well, actually I went out on my own. Dree stayed home and studied, but with some of my friends to the same area. We went and hit this tower, Irish Hills Tower, that's been closed down. It's actually two towers and some interesting stories, but there's a cache there. And then we ran all over the middle of the state there, hitting all the way up to Somerset and Lansing and Jackson. So we had a fun day of driving around and not getting a whole lot of good pictures, but ended up sick yesterday for the 12 of 12, so I didn't do anything because I was home in bed the whole time and most of it asleep. Now, Andy, I know you got a 12 of 12 done.
I did. It's my first 12 of 12 in a long time. I now have a BlackBerry, so I have a place to actually take pictures with me anywhere I'm at. So I did get that taken care of, got the 12 of 12, my first one for a long time. So I'll go ahead and put that in our show notes so you can see some of my pictures. Not real interesting, but it was nonetheless a 12 of 12. But we are back in our house now after the skunk. We kind of got it all de-skunked, and we can move back into our house. Of course, my dog still smells, but we don't have him anywhere near our house. But we are moved back in our house. It was kind of like we wanted to have a celebration almost when we moved back in because we've been gone for a whole week. So, yeah, it definitely was, you know, good to move back into our house. But you know what? That's really all that we've been doing the last week is trying to get our house to not smell like skunk anymore since my dog decided to eat it. So, really, I had no caching this week, no caching. You know, we've mainly been focusing on getting the skunk out of our house, skunk smell out of our house. Now, a couple things.
And there's nothing like being back home in your bed for the first time.
Yeah, it was really nice because as we were staying at my in-law's house and I was staying on a mattress on the floor. So it was nice to get back into my own bed. Now, we want a couple reminders here before we go on in the show. We are going to be off next week. We will not have a show on Tuesday next week. But we are going to be podcasting live from our Midwest meetup event, which will be the following Saturday. That's the 24th. The event will be GC1YRRG. And that's the event on the 24th. We'll hopefully do live on TalkShoe. We'll tweet. So follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/GC podcast.
Geocaching question of the day. Bad cop asks, you answer.
Hello, this is the Bad Cop, and welcome to the geocaching question of the day. Each weekday, I ask a geocaching-related question to my Twitter audience, and then summarize the replies and post it on my website. I hope this little project will keep you up to date on the ever-changing face of geocaching. Recently, I asked the question, do you primarily use a PC or mobile device to log your geocache finds? The vast majority, nearly 70%, use a computer to log their geocache finds. I found it interesting that 7% solely use a mobile device, such as the iPhone or BlackBerry, to log their finds. The remainder use field notes at the cache site and then finish their log on their computer at home later. So tell me, do you primarily use a PC or mobile device to log your geocache finds? Want to find out more? Follow me, the Bad Cop, on Twitter.
Before we get into the news section, I do want to remind everybody who is listening live, we are going to be doing our summer story, caching stories section this episode. So if you want to be entered into the contest to win a $50 gift certificate for cashadvance.com, go ahead and give us a call, 724-444-7444. Our TalkCast ID is 7525. If you're on the phone, go ahead and press *8 to get in our queue. Or if you're in our chat room, press the request to talk in the upper right-hand corner. But first, Montu, tell us a little bit about the news that's happened.
Yeah, Groundspeak has now included support for the offline pocket queries in their latest update. That functionality has left many users asking how the feature will be used and how to use it. Right now, the function is not accessible with the applications using the geocaching API, needing to release updates to access them. A good example, though, would be the option to upload your own custom GPX file to the geocaching.com server, then download that into your geocaching iPhone app. Look for updates to apps in the near future to access the offline pocket queries.
All right, now it's time for our summer caching stories. If you have a caching story from this summer, go ahead and call 724-444-7444. And our TalkCast ID is 7525. Go ahead and press the request to talk. Looks like we have one right now. So let's get Trip Cyclone on the phone. And why don't you tell us about your summer caching story?
Hello. Glad to be back. I had an interesting one that I thought about that happened back in June. I was up in Valentine, Nebraska, which is a small town in north central Nebraska. I was there for an event called Cash and Splash, which was actually hosted by a cacher that Daryl interviewed back last October called James Bridger. And the event was just kind of a big event. It was his main event, and we went up there, had a lot of fun caching during the day, camping in the nearby park. But that night, he had his night cache that he placed. And the cache was called Goldeneye. Now, right after dinner, while the sun was still going down, my buddies and I, and then another guy we had met up there, we decided to hit the trails, grab the caches that were on the way to the night cache, and see if we can't get a jump start to get that first find before everybody else. Mind you, it's a night cache, so you kind of have to do it at night. It was still daylight out. Well, we got the caches on the way. We got up to the starting coordinates, still well into daylight, and started searching on this hill trying to find these starting cache. Obviously, it's very hard to find reflective tacks in the daylight, but I don't know how we did it. We actually found the starting, the first stage, and each of the stages had a puzzle inside, so we had to solve the puzzle at the stage, and mind you, we're on a hill that's probably got about a 60-degree grade on it, trying to sit there and lay out all the stuff to solve the puzzle on the site. we got lucky, figured out the puzzle within a few minutes, put everything back, and then started working our way further up the hill to go to stage two. It's still daylight out when we got and found stage two. Started working on the puzzles, and one of the guys with us, TC3633, came up with it out of the blue and figured out how the puzzle worked. We got all the cords figured out, put them into our GPS, put everything back, rehid that stage, and got working on the final stage. About 45 minutes later, as the sun is still trying to go down, finally some people caught up to us. But when they caught up, we found out they had gone a different route. They hadn't even found the first stage yet. So we kind of helped them out and pointed them in the rough direction for the stage, but they had to go down the hill. Some of the people in their group went down. Some of the people stayed up there. Finally, after probably 10 minutes of searching and us still trying to find that final stage, they found that first stage, started working on the puzzle. Took them a little while to solve the puzzle. By the time they had solved it, another group had caught up to us. We were now up to 14 people trying to find this puzzle. We had been there for about 45 minutes working on that last stage before somebody finally solved the second stage and was able to join us in a search. And the funniest part of the whole thing is right before they solved it, and as we're looking for the reflective tax for the final stage, my buddy 8601 Delphinium noticed some reflectors off in the distance. We were a bit confused because they were off in private property, but we did go to look. This other guy and I went and decided to investigate. We could see them reflecting when we shined our flashlights, and at this point we could finally use flashlights. We walked over there, and about 30 feet away, I happened to notice there were ears. At first, we were like, okay, this has to be some animal there. But we noticed that it wasn't moving. It wasn't responding. We actually threw something in this direction. It landed a few feet away, didn't move, and then we started thinking. The name of the cache is called Golden Eyes. There's Golden Eye. We figured, okay, it's a fake deer. We're going to go up, and then the cache is going to be attached to it. We got up to the cache, and right as I was reaching for it, with my hand probably a foot away, the baby deer bolted and ran off. Much to our surprise and the ensuing laughter from the group behind us, we slowly, with our heads down, walked back and figured out, okay, that wasn't the cache. Finally, out of 14 people, one kid, probably, I don't know, I think around 12 years old, read the instructions inside the second stage and figured out there was a clue in there that we had to find, or that we had to use to find a cache. And within about 5 minutes, after an hour and a half of searching just for that final stage, or almost an hour and a half of searching for that final stage, we finally found it and turned a four-person first-to-find in broad daylight on a night cache into a 14-person first-to-find, and the only one who read the instructions was the kid. Ended up probably being the highlight of our trip. It was a blast figuring it out. It was a blast with everybody having a good laugh over the fact that none of us bothered to read the instructions and realized that we were looking at the final stage entirely wrong. That was my story that was my interesting story for the summer.
Well, thanks, Trip Cyclone, for your interesting story, and you will be entered into our contest. Anyone else have anything else, any other contest stories to put in for the summer caching stories? Give us a call at 724-444-7444, and our TalkCast ID is 7525. And if you're on the phone, go ahead and press *8, and that'll get you into our queue to so we know that you want to talk. Remember, guys, there is 2 more episodes to enter into this contest. Don't let Trip Cyclone be the only one in the contest. Give us a call at 724-444-7444. And our TalkCast ID is 7525. You can press the *8 to talk or the request to talk in the upper right-hand corner of the chat room. All right, well, that's going to bring us to our main topic tonight. Tonight, we are going to be talking about the Garmin support for custom raster maps, and we brought on Scott from GPSFix.com. He has definitely had some experience with this, so we thought we'd bring him on. Welcome to the show, Scott.
Hi, Andy. How are you?
Oh, I'm not too bad. How about yourself?
I'm doing fine, thanks. Good to be on the show.
Yeah, we saw that you had posted some articles about the custom maps, and so we thought we'd bring you on. Can you tell us a little bit about it? What units is it for? Give us a brief here.
Sure. I can start with a little bit of background. So first of all, the new support is for a feature called Garmin Custom Maps. And Garmin Custom Maps is a new feature that Garmin released in some beta software last week for the Colorado units, the Oregon units, and the Dakota units. So it's supported on three families of devices from Garmin. Not supported on some of the older units, at least right now anyway, and it looks like this is probably something they'll stick with on the newer outdoor handheld units. And what the feature does for you in a nutshell is it allows you to get maps onto the device that you might not already have on there, things like aerial images that you might see in something like Google Earth, or maybe paper trail maps that you might have for conservation land or an area that you geocache in that wouldn't normally be available as part of your built-in Garmin maps, but this feature provides you with a way to scan them, or if you have an electronic copy of them, to get them onto the device, overlay them onto your map page, and then you would have maps available with probably trails, things like that that you wouldn't normally have, the details that you wouldn't normally have from the built-in maps that you might have on the unit.
Now, I can see some copyright issues getting in the way with doing some of the things like satellites, but this would probably be really good for the like orienteering maps that we were talking about way back on the Topo show. So how would you get those into the unit, and I guess what's the process for it too?
Sure. So yeah, so just to touch on your first comment about copyrighted maps, and you know, Garmin is very clear about this as well, is that you do want to make sure that whatever sources you're using, you either have the copyright to or permission to use. A lot of maps, and we're starting to pull together links. We've put some up on GPS Fix, and a guy by the name of Rich Owings, who runs another blog you may have heard of called GPSTrackLog.com, actually made a really good post this afternoon and put up a bunch of sources for freely available map material that's available on the Internet. So while a lot of that's not in the format yet that you can put it directly onto your Garmin unit using this new feature, it provides a lot of the raw material that we're hoping, given some other third-party tools, we might be able to get onto these Garmin units with a little bit of work. So, yeah, copyright's an important thing to keep in mind, and make sure that people aren't distributing maps and using maps that are copyrighted. And I guess in terms of your other question in general, in terms of how you do it, and how you approach it, it's a very simple process. Essentially, what Garmin has done is this feature is based on support for a file format that Google Earth has made popular called the KMZ file. And if you look at the instructions that I put a link on the Google document that you have for this show's episode, what they use and the procedure that they show is a procedure whereby you get a JPEG image for the map that you're trying to get onto your unit. And there are a number of ways that you can get that, obviously, but hopefully you can find something maybe on the Internet, and this is something I was able to do easily for a conservation land that I have near my house, or maybe a state park that I had nearby. I was able to find a JPEG image, or find an image that was convertible to a JPEG image. And then you go through a process that's detailed in the Garmin instructions of importing it into Google Earth. You calibrate it, which is a means for locating the map on sort of the face of the Earth to tell it where the map is overlaid on the Earth. You save it as a KMZ file, and then when you've done saving it as a KMZ file, you transfer the map to your Garmin GPS, and it shows up as a map on your GPS. It's actually a pretty straightforward process and something that's based on a fairly standard format. So it opens up the possibility of using tools other than Google Earth to actually do the transfer and create the maps as well.
Now, how accurate do you find that it is? If you calibrate it right, is it fairly accurate?
Yeah, so my experience in terms of the accuracy of the maps is good. So if you take the case that I just went through, where you're taking an uncalibrated map from some source, like a trail, like a paper trail map, or maybe a map that you found online, and you're doing the calibration yourself in Google Earth, The accuracy, to some extent, is going to be determined by two things. One is the extent to which you're willing to play with it in Google Earth and try to get it to match the features that you can see in Google Earth. There's a procedure you go through to do this calibration, and the amount of time that you're sort of willing to spend there rotating, resizing, and recentering the map to get it just right is going to be one factor that determines the accuracy, and the other is obviously the accuracy of the map itself when it was made. I've found that, for example, on some of the local trail maps that I have, that some of the trails are just off. So it depends on those two factors, I guess. But for good trail maps, and if you're willing to spend 5 to 10 minutes doing the calibration, it comes out very well, actually.
Now, are there any file limitations?
Yeah, there are some file limitations that Garmin has published, and I'll add the link here. So if you go on over to forums.garmin.com, they've added some forums over on the Garmin website for creating custom maps and how to some of the technical limitations and file limitations gets into that. So we're trying to understand this a little bit better, and I think there are some general rules of thumb that seem to be coming through. One is that you really need to, the JPEG images that you import need to be relatively small. They can't be much more than 1 megapixel. So a 1024 by 1024 resolution JPEG is about the largest file size that you want to have for each of the files that you import. However, you are allowed to import in your maps up to 100 of those files. If you do some of the math, you can come up with a scenario where you have pretty good resolution on your maps and can cover an area of about 100 square miles, given those limitations. So you certainly couldn't put all of North America on, or even a whole state on the unit, but you can cover a fairly large area with some maps. And we're looking at, and you might ask, why would I need to do that? And one of the things we are looking at is there are, I mentioned earlier, there are some good free sources of maps available online, like scanned topographic maps, the USGS maps. There are obviously many sources of color and black and white aerial imagery available, and those images, to a large extent, have already been georeferenced, and we're trying to find tools that we can use to convert those files into the KMZ files that the Oregon uses, and we're very close working with a couple authors of software who already have software that does similar things, of converting those into a format that the Garmin unit can recognize. And that would give you access, and fairly easy access without doing calibration, to a lot of files and map data that would be useful on a Garmin unit. So there are a few files. There are some limitations in terms of the size, they seem to be pretty reasonable given what most people, I think, are going to want to use this feature for.
Yeah, now I know a lot of the trail maps for the parks in this area are really bad and not even close, so obviously that's going to hinder the accuracy. But no, and that's, you got to respect these park systems for at least putting out the effort, but, they're not cartographers. They're not going to be able to give us really accurate maps. But we've had a question in the chat room, which was, how hard is it to transfer maps which are already made?
So if I understand the question, there's sort of two ways to make maps. One that I just walked through, where you're calibrating and sort of the map that you found online, maybe a paper map. The second option is to transfer a map that's already been calibrated. There are some tools right now that will allow you to do that. So if you're familiar, there's an online tool, for example, called GPS Visualizer, and that's a tool, an online tool that allows you to create, and one of the options it allows you to do is to create Google overlays, and it just so happens those overlays, these KMZ files, are compatible with a Garmin map, and it's pretty straightforward to take aerial photography. In this case, it's some of the older black and white aerial photography and the USGS maps, and put tiles onto your unit. So there's one example of a tool that's already pretty close to working form for the Garmins, and I think in the next 2 or 3 weeks you're going to find that there are a number of software tools, both free and paid for, that will begin to export this new format, or this really, it's not a new format, but a format that's compatible and optimized for the Garmin that will allow you to load on a lot of already made maps. And I think that's going to be a big key to the success of this feature.
Well, and I'm guessing, too, that by using those grayscale maps, it also helps cut down the size and makes it easier to get that into your unit.
It does. And the other thing which we haven't talked about, too, is that the smaller the maps are, the faster the unit is. So one of the things you'll notice is that compared to using the vector maps, which are the standard maps that are built into your unit, that are sort of optimized for performance in terms of zooming and panning and moving, these maps do tend to be a little bit slower because you're there's a lot more data to be managed and manipulated by the unit when you're turning around or you're moving or you're zooming in and out. And one of the things, by keeping the files small and broken up into multiple tiles, that does improve the performance of the unit. And black and white images are going to have a little bit less data and work a little faster than some of the real high resolution color aerials that are available.
He went ahead and clarified the question. He said, how hard is it, say you've got several maps already made with you and you're traveling, how hard is it to transfer on the road? Like, can you pre-make the maps and just not transfer them to your unit already, or how does that work?
I guess the answer to that question is when. So let's talk a little bit about how that file is transferred to the GPS. So what you do, if you have an Oregon or a Garmin, you're familiar with the fact that when you plug it in, it goes into USB storage mode. There's a directory on the device that you need to create actually when you download the beta software. And when you create that directory, you simply are copying the KMZ files that are created from whatever source, typically it's Google Earth if you're creating your own maps, but it could be from some other source, into that directory. And as soon as you copy them into that directory, you unplug your unit, and when it boots back up again, it will load that KMZ file as a custom map. You can unload and reload those files by either removing those files or changing the names of those files, and they'll appear and disappear on your unit. There's also a button available on your unit that enables and disables that layer of maps on the Garmin. So if you have a Garmin, you might be familiar with some of the map setup options that allow you to enable the Garmin maps that you have installed on your unit. So if I had Topo and City Navigator road maps, I can enable and disable them separately. The custom map layer works the same way. You can enable and disable that separately from the other units once the files are loaded on.
Now, do you think that we'll see maybe, I don't know, if they're public domain maps, do you think that we'll see KMZ files publicly hosted somewhere that we can use for that too? Like, as in trading, like say I do a lot of calibration to maps here and I trade them with you. Like, do you see that will be happening? Do you think that will go?
Absolutely. I think it's already starting to happen. And again, the key there is for public domain type maps and maps that have an open copyright or a copyright that allows people to share them. But Garmin has already done a little bit of that. I mentioned the new forums at forums.garmin.com. If you look under the custom maps area, there's a thread on there where people are posting KMZ files already. I'm not sure if that's going to be the way we all ultimately do it, but if you guys are familiar with GPSFileDepot.com, which is another great resource for free maps for Garmin units, people are already starting to create them and host them there as well, too. So I wouldn't be surprised if we see people start to put them there.
All right. Now, Daryl, do you have any other questions right now?
Well, not really a question, but I'm just thinking how cool it would be to have like the 550, which has that built-in camera, be able to walk up to one of the boards someday, just snap a picture of the trail map and do the overlay right there in the field.
Yeah, that feature is not available today because you'd have to be able to somehow calibrate that against your map. So there would be some additional software that Garmin would have to do that feature. But it would be nice. You're right.
Yeah.
I frequently do that with my 550. It's one of the first things I do a lot of times when I walk into the woods, especially if I'm caching, is take a picture of that trailhead map, and then you've always got one with you on the unit.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we tend to do that with the camera phones, too. But I don't know if the Oregon currently has enough horsepower, but it's always getting more powerful and less expensive.
That's right.
Now, if any of our listeners who are listening live have any questions, go ahead and give us a call, 724-444-7444. And our talk cast ID is 7525. go ahead and press the star 8 on your keypad or the request to talk.
I think, Andy, one of the things that might be worth mentioning is this is a pretty new software that came out last week. I guess you guys probably already knew that. It is beta software, so people should be willing to assume some of the risks that go along with loading up beta software. And we have seen a few glitches along the way, but I think in general it's been a pretty stable release from Garmin. Most of the issues that I've seen have been around loading up a lot of data, loading up 50 or 100 image files and zooming in or zooming out while you're panning or navigating and doing some things like that seems to sometimes cause the unit to lock up.
All right, and also, well, we've got some time here. If you want to tell people a little bit about your website and where we can find you at.
Yeah, sure. So I blog over at a site called gpsfix.com, gpsfix.com, and I've been doing it for a couple of years, and the site is mostly dedicated to Garmin outdoor GPS units, primarily the Colorado, the Oregon, and the Dakotas. So this was right up our alley when Garmin released it last week. And we also maintain what we call the set of wikis that are associated with each of the different series of units. So we have a wiki available for the Dakota, the Colorado, and the Oregon. And the wiki includes a lot of the detailed information that owners or potential owners of each of those units might be interested in checking out. And we have a FAQ on there, which answers a lot of typical questions that users might have on their new units. And we have a list of issues and bugs and comparison tables between the different units and a variety of different features like that that allow people just to become familiar with their new GPS, or even if they've had it for a while and they want to learn how to do something new with it, hopefully help them out do that. Each one of the wikis also has a discussion area to talk about the features like this or ask questions if you have questions, and answer a lot of stuff via email or on the discussion forum. So just to encourage people to stop by GPS Fix or the wikis, which are linked on the GPS Fix homepage, and drop us a line, ask a question, or make a contribution to the wiki. We'd love to have you.
Anyone else have any questions for Scott here? 724-444-7444. And our talkcast ID is 7525. And if anyone has any questions, Scott, after the fact that we're not live anymore, can they contact you through your blog?
Absolutely. On my blog, there's a contact tab, and they're certainly welcome to contact me that way. It's a very... Just send me an email, and we can always have a chat that way.
All right. Well, we want to thank you for being on the show here tonight. It's been interesting. I'd love to get my hands on one and try it out. Unfortunately, I just have a 76 right now, so I won't be able to do that. But thanks for calling in and talking with us tonight a little bit about that new feature.
All right, Andy. Thank you very much. Pleasure being here.
If you found any value in the content of this podcast, please consider helping us make this show sound even better by visiting www.geocachingpodcast.info and clicking the donate button in the right-hand corner. We realize that there are many places you can spend your hard-earned cash, and if you decide to donate, you'll be given a link to our Plus feed. Thank you for donating. Join us each Tuesday at 9:30 p.m. Eastern on the TalkShoe service. You can call and set live at 724-444-7444. And our TalkCast ID is 7525. Our show notes and links to all of our past shows can be found at www.geocachingpodcast.info. You can call our voicemail line at 206-3503-GPS anytime and leave us a voicemail. A reminder, we will not be having a live show on Tuesday. We will be doing a live show at our live event. Follow us on twitter.com/GCPodcast so you can figure out when we're going live. And we've only got 2 weeks left in the summer caching story, so get your caching story in. Have a safe week and keep on caching.